Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Singer Rankin. She is founder and director of World Women Work. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm thrilled to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So World Women Work is an organization that does so many different things. Just briefly, how did you start?
Well, I started about 12 years ago on halfway, not even halfway, at about 10,000 feet on Kanchenjunga, the third highest mountain in the world. I was on a trek with the head of the World Wildlife Fund. And there was a huge need to empower women in environmental projects in conservation. And somehow it just came to me that really what I wanted to do was buy beautiful things made by women, sell them, and then give all my profits to women in conservation. So that's what I've done.
The link between economic development and conservation is something that we can talk about in some detail, but it's very important when you're doing conservation work, when there are endangered species and elephants and so on, not to just focus on that species, but to focus on all the communities that live around and among that species.
Absolutely. Unless people are economically sufficient who live in these areas of the world where there are elephants and tigers and whatever it might be, unless these people have an economic incentive to help protect these animals, nothing is ever going to be left. But once they have a vested interest, then their whole attitude changes.
Let's talk about your work with elephants. Well, how did you first start working with elephants?
Well, I started a long time ago. I guess it was in the 1985 or so, and I was head of the Pittsburgh Zoological Society, and I wrote a letter to Ian Douglas Hamilton in Kenya. I had just read their book, Among the Elephants, and he was at Oxford doing a doctorate in Lake Manyara in Kenya, and I was absolutely fascinated, and I wanted to meet them. And so I took it upon myself to write them and ask them to come to Pittsburgh and do a fundraiser. And lo and behold, they did. They had not a clue who I was, thought I was very arrogant to even think of getting in touch with them. But they were doing a big National Geographic thing. So they came to Pittsburgh on the way. And he, at that point in time, at the University of Pittsburgh, he made a speech. This was the last major downturn in elephant populations when the poaching was just rampant. And he was the first to really bring this to the fore. And consequently, we have all become extremely close friends. And I think that he's probably one of the greatest, well, he is one of the greatest elephant researchers in the world.
And elephant poaching is a huge industry. Because of ivory still? Is that the main reason?
It's still, it's very definitely ivory, and it is escalating again today. It's basically out of hand. And Ian, at the last CITES, the Convention on International Trading, Zambia and Tanzania wanted to have one-time sales of ivory, and this had happened a few years ago, and which started poaching. The rise in poaching again. And Ian was really the forerunner. And he, at this convention, managed to keep the elephant listed on Appendix 1. So there is no...
What's Appendix 1?
Well, it's the top... Literally, elephants are never to be poached. Nothing is to be sold. But that doesn't seem to be making any difference. And China seems to be at the forefront of almost all of it. And their huge search for resources in Africa is rampant, and certainly in the Congo and where there are many minerals, deforestation. Now, Kenya, all over, they're building roads. They're just everywhere. So
yeah, we just had somebody on. William Powers was talking about having made a deal to prevent the clear-cutting of forests in Liberia with the EU. And then China comes in, and they don't have a deal with China.
Yeah, and China's just out of sight. Just in Kenya, they're building a road in the north of Kenya. And, I mean, they document this. They see Chinese workers. To begin with, the Chinese really don't employ local people. They bring their own workers. I have read, I don't know if this is true, but they use a lot of people that have been in prison, and they bring them. And, of course, these guys, I mean, they'll do anything. And ivory is extremely valuable. And local people, in many, many instances, can make more by poaching one elephant than they would make an entire year. So there's not only the bushmeat trade, which is also a part of it, but the ivory. And that is for beautifully carved ivory things. So the middle class in China, which is getting bigger and bigger, there's a major market for it.
And they don't have awareness in China, in the growing Chinese middle class, about the devastation.
They don't seem to. I mean, I think a lot of people are working with them to try to make them understand. And, I mean, certainly the Japanese are a major market also. And the United States is not above. I mean, I think we do a lot of have a lot of endangered stuff that comes in and out of this country.
Tell us about how your work with elephants in Africa developed.
Well, the Douglas Hamiltons became close friends, and so I used to spend a lot of time with them, helping and doing fundraisers and stuff here. And then I became involved with the World Wildlife Fund, and then that led to more working with elephant conservation. And then today, with my World Women work, the first thing I did with Ian and Save the Elephants is his foundation, which is now in Samburu in northern Kenya. I've racked my brains, because the whole idea of World Women Work was to empower women, education, crafts, whatever it might be. But I also was finding more and more women that were involved in conservation. But Ian, being a man, I thought, now how am I going to do this? So I came up with a brilliant idea to do a radio collar for a matriarch. So a matriarch elephant was World Women Work's first thing with Save the Elephants. And
explain that, a radio collar.
What Ian has been doing for the past 15 years or so is radio collaring and following the movements of elephants. So
he puts devices on them where human beings can track them.
Yes, and they used to be great, huge collars. They're still collars, but it was much more complicated to get all the information back from these radio collars. Today, it's all done through a cell phone. I mean, he can look at his iPhone and see exactly where six elephants are in Mali that he has radio collared. It's absolutely unbelievable. And a group of friends in Santa Fe got together and bought a radio collar with me, and she's called the Santa Fe elephant, and we can watch. He knows exactly where this elephant goes, the fields that she goes through, but how they just zoom through places. So what it does is it helps know the patterns of where elephants go and to help protect them. I mean, if you know that they're going right straight through the main street of a village, you're going to do something to keep them out of that village.
We're talking to Singer Rankin of World Women Work. You have had some of your own encounters with elephants.
Africa would be when I first met an elephant in the back of an open Land Rover with a herd of elephants surrounding us and being told to be absolutely still as a mouse. And it is an awesome feeling, because they're huge. And you feel this power that is unbelievable. As Africa, I mean, I've gone on to Asia now and I've really gotten involved with elephants. But one of the great experiences with Oria Douglas Hamilton in Africa was being with her one morning very, very, very early down on a riverbank. And she said, you know, the elephants will come to us. There wasn't an elephant in sight. And we sat quietly and said, don't you dare say a word. And we just sat and listened to the birds and sat and sort of meditated. And all of a sudden, I mean, you never can hear, I mean, elephants are so quiet. All of a sudden, we were surrounded. And I must say, my heart was just fluttering away. It was quite scary, because they were right on top of us. And her window was down, and all of a sudden, an elephant was right along the car, and in came her trunk. And she put her trunk on Oria's arm, and we sat there, and we sat there, and must have for at least 15 minutes with this elephant, with her trunk on Oria. And as you looked out the back, all you could see were elephants.
Could you pat it? Or?
Well, no. We just sat there just as quietly as you could be. And finally, she took her trunk out of the car.
It's extraordinary to think that elephants could be quiet. You think of thundering herds of elephants.
But they are quiet, and their feet are such that they're cushioned. You don't hear them. They can appear. Katie Payne, she's now at Cornell, she was one of the first to find out how elephants communicate, and it's through their feet. They hear things that we never hear. So they know what elephants are doing 5 miles away. They hear it through their feet. They feel it, the vibrations. I remember being in Zimbabwe once when there were no elephants around, and there was a major cull going on. And, of course, the elephants, they'd all communicated to each other. They knew.
What's a cull?
Many African countries, in this, particularly southern Africa, feel that they have too many elephants and that the habitat cannot sustain it. And so they go in with helicopters or small planes and also on foot, and they will shoot, not whole herds, they'll pick out, but they'll shoot matriarchs, and then after the whole cull, I mean, they'll shoot 100 elephants. They'll come in and they'll tie their babies up, a baby up to its mother. I mean, it's absolutely, I guess, I mean, from what I've read and from people that I've talked to, it's absolutely brutal what they do.
What is your point of view about, I mean, people saying there's too many elephants. Most conservationists say there's too few, that they're endangered.
They are endangered, certainly in Asia. Asian populations are totally endangered. Africa has gone from 1.5 million down to something like 600,000 today. What has happened, though, that southern Africa, South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, and Zimbabwe manage their elephants very differently than Kenya, Tanzania. I don't know much about the Congo and that. And East Africa certainly took the brunt of the major poaching that went on in the 80s. So their populations were hurt much more than southern Africa. So, you know, some people say they have too many, some not enough.
How are some of the different both nations and then non-governmental organizations managing elephant populations and trying to end poaching and promote healthy elephant habitats?
Well, in this last go-round, when Zambia and Tanzania wanted to downlist the elephant and also wanted to have a one-time sale of their stockpiles of ivory, they feel that they have way too much ivory, which has basically come, they say, from natural causes, from deaths.
You mean when an elephant dies, they go harvest it?
And so that their stockpiles of ivory are Tanzania's, but if they sold it, would have been worth way more than $1 million. So it would be...
$1 million, that's not that much.
No, not really at all to us. But that they could use that $1 million would certainly be much more beneficial, they say, to use for conservation than to have the ivory sitting locked up someplace. Then Kenya does not want that at all, because then that's going to, they maintain, will then start poaching again. And well, poaching is going on, so. But there is a huge demand today for ivory, and that's what's fueling this whole crisis.
So how do you and how do others work with communities to preserve habitats, to preserve wildlife like elephants?
I mean, that's so hard. Well, it all goes back again to economics and trying to make the elephants worth saving in people's eyes. So be it supporting women and starting projects for them, tree planting, beekeeping. They're finding that bees, just the sound of bees, terrify elephants. So in Kenya, there's a project in Samburu under Save the Elephants of getting local people to start raising bees and have beehives along fences and whatever to keep elephants out of villages. So that is one little economic
incentive. That's interesting. So that they can harvest the honey and so
on.
They
can harvest the honey and sell it.
Are elephants known to devastate villages?
Yep. When they're hungry, they will go any place to get food. And if there's a big mango tree right in the middle of a village that they can get to, they will go and they will get all the mangoes. Villages that are in the midst of elephant habitat, elephant corridors where they've gone for hundreds of thousands of years, if they decide they see a cornfield and want to go, they're going to go into it. And they also kill people. I mean, there's no question that a number of people are killed by elephants.
You had an experience in Thailand about which I saw a little video with an elephant that was really both heartbreaking and sort of heartwarming at the same time.
That was, I think, one of the most incredible things that I have ever done. My son is a filmmaker, and we had done a film called Losing the Elephants, which was about this amazing woman, Lek, who is from a northern Thai hill tribe, whose grandfather was a shaman, and somebody gave him an elephant, and she grew up with an elephant as a child, and she became possessed by elephants, and she began to know of the brutality against elephants, and so she started a sanctuary called the Elephant Nature Park. This was 6 years ago that she started this. She is a powerhouse. And as she began to bring to light what it all boiled down to was that when logging was ended in Thailand, there were all these elephants who had been used for logging, and there was no place for them to go. So
they were used basically as work animals.
They were used as work animals, and that was very brutal. They're given drugs, methamphetamines, but to work harder. It's a brutal business. Anyway, it was stopped in Thailand. But there were all these elephants and what to do with them. So many of them went to trekking camps, which is where people can go and have elephant rides and watch them standing on their hind legs, playing the harmonica, all of which is unbelievably gruesome. They break elephant spirits, and it's something that's gone on for, I guess, thousands and thousands of years. They put them in a very, very small area that's fenced so that the elephant can't move. They're tied, and they're just beaten into submission. So, Lek made the case against the elephant trekking camps, where these elephants are worked all day long, they're chained, they're not fed enough. You think of an elephant as being huge and able probably to carry hundreds and hundreds of pounds on their back. Well, that's not the case at all. Their backs are very, very fragile. So they put these big sort of wooden seats on them and will put four people on. The owners of these trekking camps tried to kill Lek, and so she had to go from one safe house to another. The government got mad. It became a true mess. Anyway, she's persevered, and things are better today, basically, because of her in some areas. So last year, we went to do a second part of Losing the Elephants, and we specifically went to Surin on the border of Cambodia, which is one of the big elephant, about at least 300 elephants come there. It's sponsored by the government, and there's a lot of buying and selling. There are enactments of old wars with guns going off and firecrackers. So our purpose was to buy an elephant, and so Lek finally found an elephant. And so we went out, and this was out on an army base, and there were all these elephants chained. It was one of the most brutal things I've ever seen. And we found our elephant, Buloy, and she has a broken back leg from a logging accident. She had been, then after the logging ended, she had been begging on the streets of Bangkok, and then she was being forcibly bred for babies, and they would be taken away from her.
Now, all of these things, they sound so much like human suffering when you talk about them. Begging on the streets in Thailand, playing the harmonica, sitting on their hind legs. having your children taken away from you. I mean,
I think it is. I think it's very similar. And I somehow equate the problems of elephants with what women face today, with all of the abuse, or is exactly like an elephant.
Do they experience emotions as far as you know, the way we do?
They definitely do. They try to commit suicide. In fact, the day that we bought Buloy, there was an elephant that was tied out in the sun. They have no shade, no nothing. Their front legs are hobbled, and then they're on a tiny, tiny chain, no water. And this elephant was throwing himself on the ground repeatedly, which he was trying to commit suicide. They also will abort babies when things are not good, and they also seem to be able to regulate their own family planning. When there's not enough food, when things are chaotic, they will not get pregnant. Death is something that elephants come to a dead elephant, and they'll come and they'll try, say if it's a matriarch who has died, they will try to pick her up off the ground. They'll try to bring her to life again, and then a whole herd will come as though paying respects to her. Yeah, they're extremely intelligent.
We're talking to Singer Rankin of World Women Work. So you were able to save this one elephant from a horrible fate, but the rest of its companions
are still there suffering. But the end of that story, that was so incredible. It was 22 hours in a truck back to the elephant nature park. Her owner wanted to take her back to the village where she lived because they wanted to have a farewell ceremony for her. And you see all of this abuse and whatever, and yet at the same time, there is a great love of elephants. And so we had to go to the village with the truck and got there. It was at night, and there were all these men sitting around, I guess the owner and his buddies, and they were all drunk as skunks, and there was a pig's head in the middle. They were sitting on the ground. They just had dinner. So you saw this, and then we finally got Buloy onto the truck, and off we went, and everybody came up and crying and patting her and saying goodbye. And so 22 hours later, we get to the Elephant Nature Park, and we drive in, and they open the back of the truck, and her chains were taken off probably the first time in her life. And she walked down to the river with her mahout. And
her what?
Mahout, which is a man who stays with an elephant basically all of its life, and drank, and then they sort of walked off. It was like walking off into the mist. But the next morning, we got up very early and went out because they were filming. And I was following quietly behind, and it was very misty. And out of the forest came this elephant. And they came together, and all of a sudden, their trunks twined around each other. And they felt each other's faces. And it turned out that they had grown up in the same village and that they had begged on the streets of Bangkok together and hadn't seen each other for 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. I know. And they knew each other.
They knew each other.
And they said, oh, hail fellow.
Right, exactly. It was as though you and I hadn't seen each other for 2 years and ran into one another on the corner.
We're talking to Singer Rankin of World Women Work. You also do work in Malaysia. Tell us about that.
I am working with a wonderful group in Sabah called Hutan, and they're a French couple. They basically went, because they're doing a lot of orangutan research along the Kinabatangan River, and I got involved working with women. And I am working with, I think it's four or five Muslim widows who have started their own tree planting project under the auspices of Hutan. But they are reforesting. I mean, the object of this whole project is a reforestation of corridors between fragmented bits of forest in oil palm plantations.
Now, this is something that we have talked about on this program before, but probably a lot of people don't know this. Oil palms, which the oil from palms, which is found in so many products that we use without even knowing it, grows on plantations that are often in places where forests used to be. So there are tremendous consequences both for native wildlife and for global warming.
Right. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen, you get to Sabah, and there's a sort of quite high mountain. It's not high by our standards, but you can go up, walk up in the forest. It's in a national park, Kota Kinabalu, and you look out from that, and as far as you see nothing but oil palm plantations. It's like looking at the ocean. And, I mean, all the incredible forests have been cut down to plant oil palms. And I, after getting involved in this, started looking on the backs of food packages, in drugstores, on products that we buy. It's everywhere.
Palm oil.
And I don't know what's happened with the EU, but at one point it was thought to be a wonderful substitute for gas, like ethanol.
Right. And I just got a little email saying you can buy palm oil candles. You don't have to use paraffin candles, which are from petroleum. But it's not such a beautiful, clean fix.
It's not a clean thing at all, no.
What are the negative consequences of these palm oil plantations?
Well, what happens is that they've cut down all of the forests. And so orangutans would be left, in just a teeny little area with maybe four huge trees. I mean, they can't
use palm oil areas.
No. And so when they go into palm oil plantations and pull down a palm tree, I mean, sometimes they're killed. If the manager is nice, they'll get them out. But they're not allowed in oil palm plantations. But, I mean, who's to tell an elephant where they're allowed to go?
Or an orangutan.
So it's a huge problem. That's why this group that I'm working with, these Muslim women, not only is it empowering them, they're so proud of what they're doing. And so they also have little plantations of trees that they sell. They're teaching children. They get kids involved in planting. And so they're reforesting is what they're doing. So that's a very exciting thing. Again, working with women, which is all in conjunction with wildlife.
Now, they're reforesting, and there's also another term which is perhaps not known to everybody listening, which is the term wildlife corridors.
Corridors, exactly. If there's any hope of preserving anything, you have to keep these corridors open or make corridors so that they can go from one place to another, because it's become so fragmented, and this is true in Africa also, but certainly not like Borneo and the palm oil. If they can get from one place to another for food, but also for DNA, I mean, when populations become so small, then it's just not sustainable.
So they have to basically go to new places and sort of migrate back and forth for food and for mating and raising families.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So these Muslim widows are doing this reforestation work, and are they being paid by Western organizations that have contributed so that they can do these projects?
Well, they're being paid. These women are being paid by World Women Work. So it's one of my projects. They're economically benefiting greatly from this, but on top of it all, it's empowered them and made them feel important and a part of things. And they have a real reason to hope that these corridors exist and that the orangutans and elephants will take them. And so consequently, they care.
Now, have you seen, has it been successful? Are these corridors open and wildlife are using them?
They're beginning to, yeah. And they also, which I've not seen because I haven't been back to Saba for about 3 years, they started doing these bridges that go across rivers. What do you call them? Like a hanging
suspension bridge.
Suspension bridge, exactly. And orangutans are using those bridges.
Now, you have also done, and maybe are still doing, work in Nepal.
Do a lot of work in Nepal. I have many scholarships in Nepal over the years. And I think World Women Work, it's hard, but probably about 350 scholarships in the Himalayas and in Africa. But today, I have scholarships with some young girls who've grown up around Mount Everest who are going to school, and they have to go to boarding school. So they're being sent to Kathmandu to school, which is extremely exciting. But even more than that, that's where I really buy some of my most beautiful things, pashmina shawls and jackets and sweaters and all kinds of wonderful things. And I was just there in April, and I came away even more possessed about somehow trying to make people understand. I mean, the way I raise money mostly is by having shows and selling the things that I buy.
You had a wonderful Christmas show a few years ago.
Yeah, all over the country, and is to make people understand that what they're buying, that they're not in Dillard's, that they're buying things from me that people have made who I know who live in incredible places. And Kathmandu, number one, is probably, I've gone there for years and I've watched that valley change from an idyllic, beautiful place to today with overpopulation. It's as though the world's out of control. Kathmandu, the pollution, the noise, the garbage, it's just off the wall. And yet in the middle of this chaos are people who are making things, just for me, for example, for World Women Work, who are creating the most beautiful things. And I just think it's so important that people realize how much it means to these small, small little businesses in supporting. I mean, in other words, it's so important that I'm supporting the men and women who make these beautiful things, that that's changing their lives. And most of the people that I buy from in Kathmandu, in one place, were all untouchables. And so there's such an interest by the people who organize and who design and who make all this possible to help other people.
And so this isn't a conservation project so much as it's really an economic development
project.
It's all project.
Economic.
They are able to feed their families and
they're able to feed their families. And I'm able to sell something that they've made that is so beautiful that somebody here in the United States buys, and then that is going right back to Africa or to Nepal to send a child to school or whatever.
We're talking to Singer Rankin of World Women Work. Let's go back to Africa. You were also involved in a family planning clinic in Kenya.
Yes. That is at Lake Naivasha. This is under Oria Douglas Hamilton's auspices. And what is really interesting is that when women used to come, it's not only just family planning, it's also for other medical things, but family planning is certainly a major part of it, that women used to come, and it was very difficult for them, and God knows when they got home, if their husbands found out, they'd be beaten or whatever. Today, it's changed very much. Men are coming also. What is interesting, too, about this is that Lake Naivasha is surrounded almost on all sides by huge flower farms. And they ship, is it Holland that has the big flower market?
Yeah.
And when that volcano erupted, I remember seeing and reading, you know, all these flowers were in warehouses. They couldn't send them.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
But people have come from all around because there's employment to work in these places, and they're pretty horrible. Women are abused, raped. But on top of it, they use all these fertilizers and pesticides, which the runoff goes into Lake Naivasha, which used to be one of the most pristine lakes of East Africa. And today, the shoreline is just receding, 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 and fish can't live in it. And so that, again, then brings up the whole problem of, you know, somebody, I love beautiful flowers in the middle of the winter. It's wonderful to buy them, but, you know, one kind of has to think where they're coming from. But then,
so it's the pesticides and fertilizers that are used in these flower farms.
In the flower farms. So is it good to buy those flowers? And yet at the same time, it's giving somebody a job who is just living on the edge. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
But then it's taking away their food supply if they're eating the fish from the lake.
Yeah.
So how do you, I mean, part of the problem is thinking you're, not that it's even your job. I mean, in a sense, you know, there's a lot of people who object to Westerners or Americans going into poor countries and telling them what to do and how to solve their problems. But I mean, when you look at a situation like that, what is the elegant and beautiful solution and correct solution to the situation that you just described?
I don't know what it is. I guess, obviously, and is not using these hideous pesticides and things and doing it organically and doing it in a much more sustainable way. But how do you make this happen? And these companies, I mean, are all supplying, I mean, a lot of them are owned by Kenyans, but also a lot by foreigners, are supplying the European market. And it's not just flowers, it's also things like haricot vert, vegetables that you can't get in England in the middle of January or France or wherever. So, you know, these countries are producing stuff that people want and giving jobs to people, and yet at the same time destroying the environment. So I don't know what the answer is.
One of the things, Singer, that you're involved in also is these elephant watch safaris. Have you been on these? Do you go on these?
I have with Oria. The elephant watch safaris was started by Oria. She built a beautiful camp in Samburu in northern Kenya, which is about 10 minutes from where Ian's research center, Save the Elephants, is. So it's sort of a wonderful combination of those two. It's an incredible place to go and stay and then become intimately involved with Ian's work. All the Samburu who work for him and for Oria, their knowledge of elephants is absolutely unbelievable, and they are not doing a doctorate from Oxford or anything like that. They are on the ground. They can identify 200 elephants. They keep notebooks. They know where they...
Meaning they know the individuals?
They know the individual elephants. They draw them. They know which one has a hole in his right ear. They know every little detail, and they know the herds. They're incredible, and you meet these people, and you realize they have such a vested interest in it, and they're so proud of working with Ian and proud of being a part of this and sharing their incredible heritage, and it's theirs.
Have you seen in Africa African-based conservation projects that are working? In other words, not people from the outside coming in?
Oh, yeah. I think there are lots of them.
World Women Work is also involved in some projects in Zambia. Tell us about that.
Yes. On the lower Zambezi, which is one of the most beautiful parts of the world, parts of Africa I've ever seen. And this is due, again, to a friend of mine who has become very involved in the Lower Zambezi Conservation Trust, and basically trying to do just what we've been talking about, is empowering women and bringing villages back to life and giving them a real reason to want to protect the heritage that they have. And the Lower Zambezi, or there are still huge elephant populations and cheetah and lion, but I have gotten involved in sending women to sewing school, to tailoring school, as they call it. And the first group, I sent four women last year. The requirements are that they have to have a ninth grade education and they have to speak English. And they go for 4 months. None of them have ever left their villages. They've never been away from home. They come back. They're making all kinds of things now. They are very excited. They're making things for lodges along the river. Hopefully, they also can make uniforms for the staff working in lodges. They're making bags and things that World Women Work can sell. So that's a huge success. And this year, I'm sending seven more, plus 10 women to organic farming school. I was there last fall. It was a major get together of a whole group for a day in Lusaka of the most incredible women I have ever met in my life. These women are lawyers, they're bankers, they're just powerhouses, and they are so turned on by helping their counterparts in villages in the country. We then went out to a village, Chiawa, which is also, that's where some of my tailoring ladies come from. And we spent a whole morning. But at the end, there was a question, how many people in this room? And now, mind you, this was an old building. There were no windows. The wind was blowing through and the dust and the dirt. And there were all these incredible African women sitting around on the floor. And she said, how many people have been abused in this room? And of course, you know, you never know, but almost every hand went up. And so then there was a whole conversation of how in villages to set up some sort of, not a safe house exactly, but how to set up a way in which when people were being abused, if they could somehow get to safety.
So, like we have here,
like
we have a shelter.
Right, exactly. And this goes on not just there, but in Nepal. You know, children, girls are sold into prostitution all the time from families. And every place that I work, it is prevalent. And so that is, this is one of the most exciting things that's happened for World Women Work, really, is being able to help bring Nicholas Kristof to Santa Fe.
Tomorrow night at the Lenzick, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think there's tickets left, although you can call them and find out. And, of course, he's one of the people who writes most about these women.
Right, in the New York Times, and his book...
Half the Sky.
Half the Sky. And I just had read that last fall and was so possessed about bringing him here. And I knew World Women Work didn't have probably enough. I couldn't do the whole thing. And finally, I don't know, I found that the Folk Art Market wanted to do it also. And we came together, and it's a wonderful, wonderful collaboration for me because I've never really been a part of the Folk Art Market. And it's extremely exciting to be able to do this.
It comes up over and over when we talk about conservation and economic development that women are the focus, and your organization is certainly an example of that. Why women? Why World Women Work and not just World Economic Development and Conservation Work?
It's a really interesting thing. When I started this, as I say, 12 years ago, you know, it's so important that women be empowered in conservation. And at that point in time, I don't think there was any other environmental organization that was focused on this. And the fact that I managed to get myself into this when I did, of education, empowerment, and then, of course, conservation was my other major component, is beyond belief to me that I am in the right place at the right time.
Do women have any particular skills or proclivities?
Yeah, women are the ones who go out and gather wood where there is wood for fires, cow dung for their fires. They know what's going on. And I don't say this in a nasty way at all, but certainly in places in that you'd see men are just drunk and asleep under a tree. And women are doing all the work. Time after time, you see, I mean, how they pick up when they're given an opportunity, just like these women going to tailoring school or the Muslim women planting trees, whatever it might be, they're given an opportunity and they run with it. And I don't know. They just obviously are much more connected, I guess, is a good word to use. And you see them, I know one time, a long time ago, in Nepal, at Jomsom, which is right up before you go through Dalagiri and up into the high Himalayas, I was working with a group of, they were called the Ladies Association, and they wanted to, they'd somehow bought an old house, and they were going to make it into sort of a their own little convention center, and so then they would rent it out, and they'd make money by renting it. And then they were going to use the money from that to plant trees, and also there were no bathrooms, there was no nothing, so they were going to make some communal loos. And these women, they were powerhouses.
It is amazing to me how so many women in the world do way more than their share of the work and are abused at the same time, and when given half a chance, they take over the world, and they're just the idols of people like you and me.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, you wonder, I mean, you look at things, you look at groups of, say, in Afghanistan or wherever it might be, and you always see just men. They're never women. I guess they're not allowed to be there anyway.
Well, heck, in the cafes in Italy, at least when I was studying there, it was the same way.
It was the same way, and yet it, I mean, what are the men doing? They're making a mess. And women, I mean, would we be fighting wars all over the world? What are we all thinking about? I know from everything that I do that women make a huge difference.
Singer Rankin is founder and director of World Women Work. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I loved it.